Let's begin, why don't we? And ask God's presence, would you stand, please? Eternal Father, we're grateful to you for, again, extending your mercy to us to allow us to see another Sabbath day. And part of our activity is to pause now to take a look into your word, to become more familiar with it, to let it be our yardstick and to be a judge over us. And help us then drink of your word to implement it in our lives and make it such a close part of us that one will see your words in our lives as we present ourselves to the world. And we ask these things in your blessing. In Jesus' name, amen. I wrote on the board one of those fancy terms, liturgy. Popular in other religions, and I thought maybe somebody could define that for me. Anybody want to tackle that? Sounds really impressive, right?
Form of worship.
Everybody agree with that? That liturgy means form of worship, form of service. Well,
ceremony.
What was it?
Ceremony.
Actually, form is the best deal, or order of. And that's basically what you're talking about, and it may encompass a lot of different elements. In the Catholic Church, there's a form or a formula. In the Episcopal Church, it is pretty much the same, though a bit modified, and you can go to various churches and there will be an order of service or a liturgy. Some include responsive reading, some include more singing, some include a lot of different things. So when we talk about the liturgy of the CGI for weekly Sabbath service, that's one thing. When you talk about the liturgy of the Passover or Lord's Supper, that's another. So today we're going to take a look at the order or the form of the Lord's Supper or Passover. I will, it depends on how it goes, but if I simply say Passover, you'll know I mean the Lord's Supper. If I should say the Lord's Supper, you'll know I'm referring to Passover because we use them interchangeably, though technically they have different meanings. But by our tradition, we have come to establish that when we say Passover, we talk about the entire season, and maybe we may specify the night in which he was betrayed. But just in the general terminology, we mean a lot of different things sometimes when we use just simply the phrase Passover. Why do we do what we do? Well, you cannot turn to a passage in the Scriptures in the New Testament and get an order. It's just not there. What is there is a history, and by scouring through the Scriptures, you get a sense of the timing. One of the difficulties in arriving at the exact order of things is that the Synoptic Gospels, anybody know what I mean when I say synoptic gospels? Synoptic gospels. Anybody? That's a fancy word too, but it has a. It's the three gospel accounts. Frank just mentioned it. It means Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It means that those are. You see the kind of the term synopsis in there, or anything with sin on it, like, I mean, not S-I-N, but S-Y-N, has a sense of bringing it together. Synergy is a word where you'll find that term in there, S-Y-N. It's, I guess you would call it a prefix, but it's implying that there are gospel accounts of the four that are more harmonious. So the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, have essentially all the information we need, except you will not find in those gospel accounts a reference to the foot washing. So if you were going to say, I like Mark's account, or I'm for Luke, or I really like Matthew, you would not have an authority at all for the foot washing service that is included in our form or liturgy of Passover. But John, who wrote much later than the other gospel accounts, seems to have made up for it by saying in his own mind, he doesn't say this in the text, he just simply says, they left this out. This is very important. I think I better correct the record, at least in this aspect, because when you read the book of John, you have a sense that he fills out what the other gospel writers did not include. So if we were just to rely on the synoptic gospel account, we would not have foot washing, which is why most churches don't have it. But the 13th chapter of John gives us that in great detail, and it confirms or underscores the life that Christ led of setting an example, of doing things to lead the disciples and to instruct them on how to teach those who were to follow. So as I said, if you go to the scriptures in the New Testament, try to find an order of the foot washing, or I should say the order of Passover or Lord's Supper, it's not going to be there. But you will find distinct elements, and it is up to somebody to make a decision on how you're going to put them in order. What you will find is the bread, the wine. You will find a record of the foot washing. You will also find a record of Christ's final discourse, the things he said before he was taken. You will also find reference to the singing of a hymn. Those five elements: bread, the wine, foot washing, a farewell discourse, if you will, and then a hymn before he went off towards the Brook Kidron, I think it was, that he was about to cross. We'll find that out as we read through the record. If you'll turn quickly then to 1 Corinthians 11, because Paul puts into perspective an important element here when we are looking at a history of the Lord's Supper. That's what he calls it in this chapter. Historically, in the church, we had avoided using this terminology because we wanted to give it up to the Protestants. We let them have it. That's silly. Because in Paul's writing, that's essentially what he calls it. In verse 20 of 1 Corinthians 11, therefore, when you meet together, it is not to eat the Lord's Supper. Implying a lot of things beyond just the bread and wine, but it instructs us that there was a meal being served. Because we will see that distinctly as we go through in establishing the liturgy, that much of what happens in the midst of a dinner. I interviewed Alan Dershowitz earlier this week about his book called The Vanishing American Jew. And I said, I'd like to have a little fun sometimes on the program. So I said, I've been accused of being a Jew because, you know, Passover is coming up, and I observed those days, you know. And he says, oh, yeah, that's good, because the last meal that Christ had with his disciples was a Seder meal, a Passover meal. And he said, of course, we had Anwar Sadat's daughter over for a Seder meal on one occasion, you know, and he just kind of got to talking from that. But I just wanted to slip out into the public that the bro keeps the Passover, so they'll chew on that a little bit. But the point being is that the assumption is that what Christ did was a Seder meal. It's incorrect, but that's the conclusion that people have about it. And so many Messianic Jews attempt to make the Lord's Supper, the last meal, the Seder meal. I mean, they've gone through elaborate effort to prove that that's the case. And so now there are certain segments of mainstream Christianity that will have this so-called Seder meal because surely that's what Christ did, and so we're going to do that too. That's not what happened at all. In fact, if the Passover meal that would have been traditionally eaten, that would have been eaten the night afterwards, because the lamb had not been slain yet, which is an important element in the Passover meal, in keeping with the ancient tradition from Exodus 12. So it's problematical with folk, and we should be really grateful to God that He has guided our understanding in this, to where there are just a very few of us who understand this and comprehend it significantly. So when Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 11, in verse 23, he says, he's setting things in order because they had gotten out of focus too, even in the first century church. He says in verse 23, "For I received from the Lord, not from my own imagination, not from the writings of anybody else. I, Paul, received directly from the Lord that which I also delivered to you." This is not hearsay, Paul is saying. It's not how you guys are doing it now, because that's what I'm correcting, he tells them. "That the Lord Jesus, in the night in which he was betrayed, took bread." Now, we can go back to the Synoptic Gospels and determine what night that was, because many concluded, even in Robinson's Harmonies of the Gospels, which I have here with me today, a total misunderstanding, because they call this meal that Christ was involved in the Paschal meal, Paschal being the Hebrew expression for Passover. That's what he was doing. Well, he wasn't doing that, because that meal was could only be served after the high priest had killed the lamb, and then it was eaten on the night of the first day of unleavened bread. This is always controversial this time of the year, because different people see it differently. But the fact is, that's the way it went. But on this night in which he was taken or betrayed, he took bread, verse 23, and he gave thanks. And he broke it and said, "This is my body," or "it represents my body. Do this in remembrance of me." So this is Paul's accounting of one of the elements present in the liturgy, or in the form or the order of what happened on the night in which Christ was taken. Verse 25 stipulates another element. "In that same way he took the cup also after supper, saying, 'This cup is the new covenant of my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me.'" But what it does not say here is what was in the cup. Notice that. Doesn't say, but it could have been water. Of course, it could have been a miracle, just like he did change the water to wine, right? That's a little joke, of course. But he does not mention here what was in the cup, so many could just look at that and make an argument. Well, you know, it doesn't say it was wine in the cup, but by implication, that's what was in it. But we go back then to the Gospels and the confirmation of other aspects of the form we find in the Synoptic Gospels. Have I lost anybody thus far? Are we kind of all moving along? If you have any questions, be sure to indicate by raising your hand. We don't want to leave anybody behind as we pursue this subject. Now, so those two elements, bread and wine, or the bread and the cup, are indicated by 1 Corinthians 11. Paul here, again, setting in order or setting straight what the purpose of the evening was. It was not to have a party and to have a big meal. Some people even want to attempt to duplicate the meal that they had on that night in which he was betrayed. But a big meal is more suitable for the night afterwards, as you begin the days of unleavened bread. We call it the night to be much observed. Yes, ma'am.
Is there any indication here that he used a different bread, like the Passover or the unleavened bread? Because they would not have had unleavened bread this night.
Well, it doesn't indicate it here. You can only consider that if they were going to de-leaven, they do it in a timely fashion. They don't wait to the last minute like many of us. They wouldn't have done that. they would have already moved in that direction, because you're only a night away, and tomorrow, how busy we're going to be. We've got to get down to the temple, I mean, for the ceremonial slaying of the lamb, and we don't have no time to go back home and get all that done, so it's going to be done. In the environment of Sabbath keeping, Passover observance, in our time where, you know, house to house can be very different. So the likelihood is that this is unleavened bread, because what is he going to symbolize with the bread that he's going to pass among them? Now, will there be leavened bread present? We can argue both ways, because he does give a sop of something to Judas, you know. Is leavened bread good sopping stuff? I mean, you know, I don't think so. It's not what you call great appetizing stuff anyhow, but we don't know that. You can just speculate all around it. But the most likely indication from how Christ would have done something would be that there was only unleavened bread present during during this particular meal. Okay, now let's look then at the Synoptic Gospels. I'm going to be referring to Matthew, Mark, and Luke to just give you an order of what is happening, and actually when it's happening. Okay? Now, I should tell you this, that Mark, the scholars agree that Mark is essentially the template or the outline upon which maybe Matthew and Luke drew in writing their gospel accounts. That's just so you'll know that's how the scholars look at it. Mark is very terse, very to the point, and you will find in Matthew and Luke the elements that are in Mark, but in an expanded version, so to speak. So even in Robinson's commentary, the way it's laid out is, not commentary, this is his harmony of the Gospels, what he does is put Mark first, Matthew and Luke, and he lines them up, you know, in columns. And then, when appropriate, he puts John in the same order to give you some idea of how things went. So in Mark 17, Mark 14, excuse me, and in your notes you might write the parallel Matthew 26 and Luke 22. I'll give you the verses as we go through them. What is indicated then is, when it was evening, this is of course following the instructions he had given them to go into the city, find a man carrying this water pitcher, tell him the Lord has need to keep the Passover, and there will be a room prepared, and they go in and scout all of that stuff out, and that has all been done now. And now we arrive at evening having come. He comes with the 12. That's what Mark says. Matthew says, now when even was come, and he was sitting at meat with the 12 disciples, well, at meat, this sounds like more of a meal, because the meat is not part of the Passover symbols or the Lord's Supper symbols, are they? Not. No, they aren't. So, meat is an old expression anciently that has a reference to a meal, of sharing a meal, so that's what was going on here. Luke is much more expansive than Mark and Matthew on this account. In Luke 22 and verse 14, it reads like this. And when the hour was come, he sat down and the apostles with him. Well, Mark and Matthew establishes there were 12. And he said unto them, with desire I have desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. Now, because of that wording, many conclude this was the Passover meal, and he did it a day earlier than the Jews, and this is what was happening. You can look at it that way, but it seems to me that he was expressing a desire to eat the ensuing Passover with them, but he can't eat the Passover with them, because he's going to be dead. He's going to die as the Passover lamb. 1 Corinthians 5, Paul says, Christ, our Passover, is slain for us. First Corinthians 5 and verse 7, I think it is. So in order to be the Passover and to die simultaneously with what the high priest is going to be doing at the temple out on Golgotha, Christ is going to have to die about the ninth hour. That means that he is expressing a desire that cannot be fulfilled unless we do this early. Unless we do this earlier than it's normally going to be done. This is a big argument among a lot of folk about this scenario, this time frame. Christ changed the Passover from what the Jews would normally... No, he didn't change that. He didn't do that at all. They were going to eat it the next night, the Jews. No ifs, ands, and buts about it. After the ceremony is over, they roast the lamb, they go into their homes on the first night of unleavened bread, which comes at sundown, and it corresponds with what we call the night to be much observed. That's how we've taught it. Big speculation about it all over the place. One man wrote a book this thick, well, maybe about that thick. 300 pages. Fred Coulter has written 300 pages, and Charles Gross, I have to credit him with this great observation. That man wrote more than God did on the subject. Yeah, it's gibberish. But all to try to prove some obscure point that is meaningless. So if you ever run across it and feel, man, this guy's got something. It's not... Excellent point. You see, what we have come to know and to understand is that there is not a blending of what anciently happened in Exodus 12, which only happened one time. It never happened that way again. You see, they never put the blood on the doors again. So trying to make what Christ did fit Exodus 12 is impossible. Only professionals can try this. Don't attempt to do this at home. It doesn't work. But that's what the effort is. We have understood and teach that what Christ is doing stands alone. That's why Paul said in 1 Corinthians 11, on the night in which he was betrayed. That nails it down when it happened. And he was betrayed the previous evening before the Passover lamb was going to be slain, and then symbolically everybody eat it after sundown on the first day of unleavened bread. That's, hope I don't lose anybody with that, but that excellent point. It is a divisive issue because of trying to marry those two things together. What Christ did? Oh yeah, it only happened that way one time, because then it's left up to the disciples to carry it forth, and Paul doesn't even mention foot washing in his discourse to the Corinthians. We must assume that they were still doing it. Which brings up a whole another question when we get to John 13 as to the authority to do foot washing. He did say that, but some make the argument, and I'll just go ahead and present this, that there must be two witnesses, because it's only mentioned once in the scriptures. There was not a confirmation in the accounts. I mean, this is an argument. I just want you to be aware of the argumentation that comes around. It's only mentioned one time, unlike Matthew, Mark, and Luke, that give us the bread, the wine, and all of that kind of stuff. There are three witnesses there. But in John's case, there's only one, and we have to take his word for it. Well, I kind of like John's witness on that one, but some people will make that argument. Don't be trapped by it, but that's the argument they use. Okay, so we're in Luke now, where he says, I desire to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. You notice that he's qualifying what I'm doing here. I want to eat this with you. Normally we would be eating this tomorrow, but I want to eat it with you before I suffer. All right? So that's why it seems to be done out of the normal order, but it means that he's making it distinct. And in order to carry on to the tradition of Christ, Paul tells the Corinthian church, in the night in which he was betrayed, he took bread and he took wine. That's why we do it when we do it, because it corresponds with the night in which he was betrayed. It does not have the kind of connection that we have attempted to make over the years between what Christ did and what they did in the Exodus. It really is not connected, except in a larger symbolic sense of coming out of sin. But it's not a rehearsal of the same history at all. It's a new history that Christ is writing. Okay. For I say unto you, I will not eat until it be fulfilled in the kingdom of God. So these three accounts, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, establishes that the 12 were there, and Christ wanted to eat this particular meal with them. Now, this is where John 13 comes in, according to Robertson's Harmony of the Gospels. John 13. This is where the foot washing comes in. Because in the eating of this meal that Christ says he desires to eat, the meal is interrupted by three events, or three things. It's interrupted by the foot washing, because why is he washing the feet? That's something you would have done coming into the house. So obviously he has a larger lesson in mind in interrupting the meal, as John describes it, and girding himself up and washing his disciples' feet, because that would have been done coming into the house by a lowly servant. You've come from the dusty road, you wash your feet to prepare to eat the meal. So they've already really done that. But now there's a symbolic action that comes in the midst of the meal that interrupts it. All right? Now, second interruption in this meal is an announcement of a betrayal. Announcement that somebody sitting here in this meal with me will betray me tonight. And the third aspect in this interrupted meal is that Judas, knowing that he is whom Christ refers to, leaves before the symbols of the bread and wine are administered. He's there for the foot washing, but he's not there for the implements, as we call them. So those are the interruptions that occur during the course of this meal. Let's look at the first interruption. John 13. Now before the feast of the Passover, Robertson tries to wrestle with this dilemma, because John is very clear about this. It corresponds exactly with what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 11, before the Passover and the night in which he was betrayed. But in order to try to make it wed with the common notion, here's what the commentary says here. It is needlessly inferred that John, by this expression, means that it was a full day before the Passover meal. In fact, the words in verse 2, during supper, rather implies that before Passover was just before the meal began. That's the explanation that they attempt to give, which is silly. We all understand English. But they want you, and Robertson and this, want us to understand it. Well, you know, this means that, and that means this, and so forth. But that's just not the case. He gives no proof of it. He just tries to make it mean what it does not say. John says before the feast of the Passover, that is, and you understand that the feast of the Passover traditionally couldn't happen until the Passover lamb is slain. That hadn't happened yet. So it is before the Passover, the feast of the Passover. Jesus, knowing that his hour was come, that he should depart out of this world unto the Father, having loved his own which were in the world, he loved them unto the end. And verse 2 gives a distinction about the supper that he's involved in that particular evening, on the night in which he was betrayed. The devil Having already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hand, that he has come forth from God and goes into God, rises from supper, that is, in the midst of the meal, this is his first interruption, and lays aside his garments, took a towel and girded himself, poured water into a basin, and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel wherewith he was girded. That was a startling event, because as I indicated, traditionally, coming off of the roads in the Middle East of those days and going into a house, you would wash your feet. So the feet had already been taken care of. The hygienic aspect of coming off the dusty roads had been taken care of, but now he's doing something different. This element, an order, is essentially the first part of the form of the Passover, the Lord's Supper, is the foot washing. Okay? Now, we only conclude that because you scour through here and okay, the meal is going on. We know that, we speculate, let's put it that way, that this would not have happened after the bread and wine because it doesn't seem to fit that way. Maybe somebody can make an argument for it, but we've concluded that that would come first, foot washing. The heavy symbolism that's included here, because who's present doing the foot washing? Who? All of the disciples are there, including Judas. He's not there for the bread and wine, so to put this later, after the bread and wine, would be inaccurate, because Judas must be here for that, and we're reading that he's there for that right here in John 13. So it fits according to trying to marry it or wed it up against the synoptic gospels. I won't read through all of John 13 here because we'll be doing that and you'll be doing it personally and so forth, but it fits in the order of being first, the foot washing. All right? Then comes the betrayal aspect, which is not part of the order or the liturgy, but just for your reckoning. After the foot washing and so forth, the Synoptic Gospels and John pick up, and this is where John marries with Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Chapter 14 of Mark, chapter 26 of Matthew, chapter 22 of Luke, and John 13, beginning in verse 21, tell us that Jesus announces, being troubled in his spirit, that someone will betray him, which increases the agony of the evening. Someone who had been with him for 3.5 years was going to betray him. Of course, all the disciples are wondering, who is he talking about? I mean, who could it possibly be? Is it I? You know, couldn't possibly be that. So following the foot washing, really a deeply moving situation where Peter is castigated for his attitude and told, if you're going to have any part, you're going to let me wash your feet, or you have no part with me. Well, wash everything on me, you know. Christ says, no, that's not what it's about. This has a deeper symbolic meaning. If I do this to you, do this to one another. And it displays an attitude of service, was what Christ was talking about, in the midst of people claiming or wondering who will be the greatest in the kingdom. That's what was going on that night among the disciples. Who's going to be the greatest? And in the midst of that, Christ shows them an attitude of service by the foot washing. Very important part of what we do on the Passover evening, the Lord's Supper evening. All right. So Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John are in agreement on the pronouncement of the betrayal. John, of course, gives a little more detail because he indicates that Peter wants to know who it is, and then he also identifies that how close I was to Christ, John does. You know, I was leaning on his breast. You know, I was close by, closer than Peter, because Peter leaned over and I heard what he said, and here's what he said. A little of that element going on there, because there was a rivalry between the two, to be sure. And Christ identifies in John, verse 27, well, of course, he told him a little earlier that whoever I give this sop to, dip the sop and give it to him, that's who it will be. But even then, I don't know that the disciples comprehend it, because he may have been giving a sop to all of them at some point in time in the evening. But anyhow, verse 27 of John 13 says, "After the sop, then entered Satan into him," that is Judas. "Jesus therefore says unto him, You that thou doest, do quickly." Now, did he say it to John? To Judas, or did he say it to Satan? Yeah, Satan had taken over Judas, so that's who he was saying it to. Do what you got to do. And unfortunately for Judas, very agonizing life after this point, goes and does what he has to do. Now, continuing then with the order of events, we've got the foot washing. We've got the announcement of betrayal. We have Judas Iscariot leaving, departing. So that would naturally bring us to, well, Christ does say something after Judas leaves, just so they don't all get pompous about themselves. He tells them, all of you are going to be offended. All of you are going to hit for that high road. Yes, sir, Mr. Kashiba. Oh yeah, he could have. But that wasn't the plan. If he had done that, then it would not have been the time for him to die. He had to die.
At that particular time.
Satan had tried to get him many times. Right out of the baptism in the Jordan River, he was hanging around in the wilderness, tempting him and so forth. And they attempted to stone him on several occasions, and he disappeared in the midst and so forth, because it wasn't time. Now it was time. Why this particular year versus another year? We'd have to go through the prophecies and wrestle with all of that, but obviously Christ said, when the hour was come, I think I read it to you. Oh, yeah, in John 13, Jesus, knowing that his hour was come, that he should depart out of this world unto the Father. It was now, according to God the Father's plan. Not next year, not somewhere down the road. It was now. And so the events hurtle on. After Judas has left, Christ tells the disciples, all of you, in Mark 14, beginning in verse 27, Matthew 26, beginning with verse 31, Luke 22, beginning with verse 31, just write those down and marry them together later, and also in John 13, verse 31, he begins to tell them, all of you are going to be offended, all of you are going to head for the hills because of me. And Peter makes this great deal, not me. I'm going to be with you all the way to the ends of the world. I'll die for you. Well, of course, Christ tells him that's just not the case. You're going to deny me three times before the cock crows. And surely that happened. Then it brings us to the bread and wine. And Luke 22, if you'll turn there. Luke tended to give more detail about these things than Matthew and Mark, because Luke was a writer, historian. He was writing this as an official document for Theophilus. Many argue whether there was a real Theophilus or not. The Greek term for Theophilus would mean friend of God, or something like that. Theo being God, and Theophilus people of God. So it may have been symbolic, the man, but it may most likely been a real person who feared God and just wanted a history of Christ's life. That's why we have Luke. Anyhow, verse 17, he says, "And received a cup when he had given thanks." Let's make sure I got it in the right order. Luke puts the cup first in this instance. He says, he received a cup, and when he had given thanks, he said, "Take this and divide it among yourselves, for I say unto you, I will not drink from henceforth of the fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God shall come." The other, Matthew and Mark,
And 1 Corinthians 11 confirmed that the order was the bread first and the wine. So how do we decide? Was Luke wrong in this instance? Well, actually, Luke, later on in his account, after talking about the bread in verse 19 and 20, mentions this cup is the new covenant of my blood. He kind of brings us back to what Matthew and Mark and 1 Corinthians says. So if we're going to just take a vote and majority rules, Matthew and Mark and 1 Corinthians outnumber Luke. It's about that simple. You see any mystery about that? As to because Luke mentions the cup first in his talk and then mentions the bread, why don't we do it that way instead of the way we do it with the bread first and then the wine? Well, we just take a vote. Luke was not there. Yeah, he was not one of the 12, which is an excellent point. Mark wasn't there either. That was John Mark. Matthew was, and Paul says, I got this instruction from the Lord. That's pretty good. Good testimony. In writing, many times a writer will take a certain license, not to have everything chronologically stacked up, but will mention a general scope of things, and then we'll come back to, in this statement about the cup in verse 20 of Luke, he brings it right back into what may have actually been the order, which gives us confirmation then that the next proceeding after the foot washing would be the bread. And I'll go ahead and put wine up here. Oh, by the way, not grape juice. But it's been problematical over time. I'm running out of time, so I'm going to try to get this together. It's been problematical for some who may be legitimately alcoholics and would prefer not to have the alcohol because of that situation. We don't make a big deal about it. In some locales, you make an accommodation by having some grape juice in a cup, in the serving tray and so forth. It's just not a big hurrah, but you inform the people who make that request. But oinos, the Greek term, means fruit of the vine. It's spelled, I think it's like that. Oh, that's supposed to be a parenthesis. I think that's the way, if my memory serves me correctly, O-I-N-O-U-S. It means fruit of the vine. Well, grape juice is a fruit of the vine too, say Church of Christ, I think. Another operation. Yes, sir.
If you put the strong magnifying on research in that,
for a minute, which when you dig down deeper, it seems to be wine. Yes, sir. Right. Which excellent point about the division. I mean, some feel it was a common cup. Everybody drank from the same cup, which is the tradition in Jehovah's Witnesses. I went to one of their deals more than 30 years ago, and there's a common cup. And, of course, in communions in the Episcopal Church and the Catholic Church, there's a common cup. They're not the little individual cups. You go up to the altar, you drink. Everybody drinks out of the same cup. When AIDS came along, people started dipping that wafer in the cup instead of drinking in the cup, because they didn't trust just the wiping on that cup as they do, as being safe. So, I forget the terminology for dipping the wafer. But anyhow, wine in this case is a fermented deal, and so that's what we serve. In Mark's account, Mark, Matthew, Luke, and 1 Corinthians, we've got the bread, we've got the wine, that's the order, and as Richard pointed out, definitely the mention of the cup and the division part of it is brought back into line in verse 20 to indicate that they must have drank the wine in harmony with what Mark and Matthew and 1 Corinthians said. Okay? Then the next thing in the order is the farewell address. Okay? And that's when we read, after we've done the bread and the wine, foot washing bread and wine, we read from John 14 through 17. I tend to use excerpts from it. Some have read every word of it, but I tend to do it that way, drawing upon essential points, very important points that I may, and they may change from year to year. You know, it depends on how I'm reading at the time, but that's what happens, is the recounting or the referencing of Christ's farewell address to his disciples. And his disciples, as John 17 indicates, not for those who are just here now, but John 17 and verse 9 says, I pray for them, I pray not for the world, but for those whom thou hast given me, for they are mine. And later on he says something about praying on those who are way down the road, and I didn't mark it here. Verse 20. Neither for these only do I pray, but for them also that believe on me through their word. And we've been reading through their word. Let's see. That they may all be one, even as you, Father, are in me and I in you, that they also may be in us, that the world may believe that you did send me. So, that's one of the reasons we go through those words. And then the final thing in the liturgy or the order is a hymn being sung. We normally don't open with prayer because Christ didn't do that. He prays over the bread and the wine. Okay, asking the blessing of the bread and the wine. And the conclusion of the service was a hymn before they went out. And we'll see that confirmed in Mark 14 again, verse 26. Matthew 26 and verse 30. Luke 22, beginning with verse 39. And of course, John 18 says, when Jesus had spoken these words, he went forth with his disciples over the brook Kidron, which was a garden. He doesn't mention the hymn, but Matthew, Mark, and Luke do. Mark's account says, and when they had sung a hymn, they went out unto the Mount of Olives. That's Mark 14 and verse 26. And Matthew 26 and verse 30 says, and when they had sung a hymn, they went out into the Mount of Olives. Luke says, and he came out and went, as his custom was, unto the Mount of Olives. By the way, this is an interesting way Luke has it. Luke 22 and verse 39 is a clause. And he came out and went, as his custom was, and then comes the rest of the sentence, unto the Mount of Olives, indicating that it may have been a custom for him to sing, the way I read it. But we do have two distinct stipulations that a hymn was sung. Now, of course, in those days they would have sung a psalm, you know, from the Book of Psalms. And we tend to try to pick a hymn from the Psalms. Normally, I like to choose Psalm 51. The theme doesn't come to mind right now. I can't think of it. That's part of the text, but the hymn, that's not the hymn. Psalm 51 is the text, but the melody, it's a Dwight Armstrong hymn.
In thy loving kindness, Lord, be merciful to me. You know, the four verses there draw out of Psalm 51 and certainly can be applied to each of us personally. So that tends to be the hymn that I choose. But there are others that can be chosen to use as the closing hymn. And after the hymn, you notice there's no reference to praying. He's going to the garden to pray. Now, any questions about this order? Because I do have a concluding statement to make. Yes, sir.
After the foot washing came to betrayal.
Yes, sir. I don't put that in the liturgy, the form of what we do, but it fits betrayal. Judas leaving fits between the foot washing and the bread. Yes, sir. You're right. Yeah. Okay. So these are the five elements of the liturgy, the form of an order of what we do. The overall aspect of the evening is one of soberness. Not that you can't look anybody in the eye. Remember Frank and E.B. how it used to be? I mean, you would come in, you wouldn't look to the right, you wouldn't look to the left, or don't dare shake anybody's hand, or, you know,
no contact.
I mean, don't smile, don't do anything. And it was so artificial that it was, the oppressive, staggering nature of all of this was just incredible. It is not a night for asking, how's the business going, you know, and a lot of idle chit-chat. It is not that kind of evening. It really should not be that. But to greet one another is okay. It is not a night after the hymn is sung to hang around chatting. It really is not. It's a time to go and pray, because we have an opportunity to the disciples who went with him to the garden went to sleep on. We have an opportunity to go to our homes and to at least pray a little while. I'm not going to say pray an hour. I'm not going to even, put that time limit on it. As Christ said, can't you just pray with me an hour? I'm not going to say that. He did, but you can make of it what you will. It is that kind of evening to where you want it to be serious. You want it to be sober-minded. You want to honor. This is a memorial, you see, of Christ's sacrifice. That's what it is. He says, when you do this, when you wash the feet, when you eat the bread and drink the wine, consider my words, and you're doing this in remembrance of me. So Christ is the focus of the evening. Then, the next day, of course, one would give some thought, though it's not a strict time thing because we're not in Jerusalem. And you got to do a lot of calculations. Let's see now, what time is it in Jerusalem? When did Christ die? That kind of thing. It's really not that crucial to do that. However, the night that later that evening is a celebration, the night to be much observed. If we had the time, I'd go into that a little bit more, but we don't. Hopefully we can get some instruction on that in the course of a sermon or something before that happens. But for now, this is the order, this is why we do it, and brought out from the scriptures the orderliness of it. Any other questions before we dismiss? Yes, sir.
Well, if someone would mention the fact that, I know it's a good time to meditate, and to meditate and pray, is there a sort of pattern? When I'm asked, I'll say, listen, if I go home, I'll meditate on what we did tonight.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that will embed it deeper into my memory.
Exactly. It's a rehearsal. It's a recounting. What did I do tonight? That's part of the examination process. As Paul said in 1 Corinthians 11, examine yourselves to see whether we are in the faith. I think that's it. Thank you for your attention.